the drive to create things. You're a writer, a photographer, a musician, a maker. You're ready to make things happen.
But chasing creative isn't always easy. Your time and energy go to your work, your family, and your life. Is it really possible to make space for the creative in your everyday?
Here at the Chasing Creative Podcast, we believe you can. We're talking to everyday creatives who have insights and action steps you can take today to make your creative plans happen.
I'm Ashley Brooks, a freelance writer and editor at Brooks Editorial and work-at-home mom of two who would love to devote more time to creative writing and journaling.
And I'm Abigail Krebs, the writer and photographer behind Inkwells and Images. I'm living my creative life nights and weekends after I get home from my job at an ad agency.
And you're listening to the Chasing Creative Podcast. Sarah Fox is an editor and writing coach who helps ambitious authors start and complete their novels. When she's not working on her own novel, she writes for Quirk Books and Imaginary Book Club. You can find her thoughts on writing and pop culture at thebookishfox.com. So welcome to the podcast, Sarah.
Thanks for having me on. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, we're really excited to talk with you. You are definitely a creative after our own hearts with the writing and the editing. So why don't you get started by telling us a little bit about yourself and your creative projects and how you got to where you are now?
Sure. So I currently live in D.C. with my corgi and husband, right near the zoo. So that's always a source of inspiration for me. And it's a lot of fun to visit the otters and the pandas. I've just finished writing a novel, which is currently in the editing process. It's a YA novel. And it all started from a very young age, my love of writing. So my mom said my first word was book, which I sighed more than even said. She said it was apparently a farm book, which I don't like farms, and I'm really not an outdoorsy person, so it amuses me that the first book that I really expressed interest in, at least verbally, was a book about the outdoors. So, and that just continued through elementary school. I loved writing, like, cutting out images from catalogs and writing little stories underneath it. Like, a story about a sheep version of Sleeping Beauty, where the moral of the story was, always have money for gas, which is a weird moral for a fairy tale, but I was like in first grade, kids are weird. And I remember when exactly I went to be a writer. It was third grade, and it was my father's dragon project. And I remember I always wanted to be a pet shopper, as I called it, which was a pet store owner. So I guess there was an animal theme. Or cheerleader, which I'm not athletic, so that dream died pretty quickly. But I remember sitting there writing it and thinking, wow, I could do this for a living. I love this. I'm like, wait, I can. So it was this huge revelation to me that people get paid to write, which nowadays some people might be dubious about that career ambition, but I found a way to do it. And I went to college, did the usual English major. I got my master's in medieval literature, and I briefly flirted with academia. But I really just, it was really political. There's limited jobs. And then also there's no geographical freedom, so you could be sent to an assignment in the middle of nowhere with farm animals, which nowadays, despite my younger self, seems mildly horrifying. So I decided to go the kind of corporate route. I became a tech writer, and it was just really, really dry. Like, standard operating procedures were exciting at first, but eventually you get tired of reading about hard drives, networks, whatever. So I discovered the online entrepreneurial world through my friend after I told her how bored I was with it. Not that I'm not grateful, but it just wasn't a right fit. And then I just went down the rabbit hole for a couple years, and it was my side gig until I could take it full time.
Yeah, I think tech writing is definitely one of the more profitable avenues for writers when they think about, like, okay, I'm an English major, and people always ask that, well, what are you going to do with that question? Technical writing, I think, is always a very tempting answer because you know you can make money at it.
Yes. It did pay well. I am grateful for funding my business for a couple years there.
That's excellent. I know I started out in B2B publishing, and I wrote about things like power tools and the supply chain for a couple of years, which, like you said, it's not sexy or exciting, but it definitely pays the bills and at least gets that little, like, line item on your resume for the next job. So everyone has to start somewhere.
Yeah, and it's fun at first. It's just after, like, always is fun to learn new things. But after a while, you're just, it gets very monotonous. It doesn't have a lot of variety.
This is very true. So you did eventually leave your full-time job not too long ago, last summer, I believe, to pursue your freelance business and spend more time writing your novel, which was obviously a good decision because you've now finished writing that novel. So was there a defining moment when you knew it was time to leave your day job, or did you plan that transition for a long time in advance?
It was a combination between the two. So I did my side hustle for 3 years. So I was saving money. I was also just investing, using my paycheck to invest in my business with like a website or online courses, and also to build my networks. But I remember telling my friends about a year ago, I have a mastermind group. I'm going to quit my job in June. But I actually didn't believe it. It was kind of one of those Disney wish upon a star fairy tale kind of dreams, I thought. It was kind of something like, it's for other people. Maybe I'll do this. But I realistically didn't think it would happen. And then I went to New Orleans. So I was, as you know, not really thrilled with my job. Great people. I'm really grateful for the pay. Like, it was fine. It was not anyone's fault. It was just not my fit. And when I was in New Orleans, there were signs everywhere. So I was kind of contemplating leaving. But then there were signs like, follow your dreams. Or I talked to a tour guide. And she was originally an engineer. And she said she quit her job to do cemetery tours to tell people like creepy kind of fun facts about them. And she's like, I don't regret it. Or an Uber driver was in finance and was talking about how much he was glad he quit his job because it was keeping him up at night. And he just like quit, and he loves help making people happy by driving. Another woman was doing Uber as a side gig. Like, everyone there in that city were like artists who were successful. Or there's literally, like, that city's full of signs literally telling you to follow your dreams. So I'm always going to be grateful for New Orleans. My husband, who's not a woo-woo person at all, was like, wow, this seems to be definitely pointing you in this direction, because I was contemplating it. So I took a week after my vacation when I got back to make sure this was really what I wanted to do and get my ducks in a row. And I gave my 2 weeks notice, and I said, I went to New Orleans. It changed my life. It was like a CCR song, like Proud Mary. I could, like, quit my big job in the city working for the man, and I started my own business, and I haven't regretted it for a single moment.
Yeah, that is an awesome story. I love that even your husband, who is not woo-woo at all, I would say the same thing about mine, was like, yep, that's a sign, we need to do this.
It was pretty exciting.
Yeah, that is. So how is your creative life different now compared to when you were working full-time and working at your side hustle?
Oh my gosh, it's like night and day. It's amazing how much more energy you have when you don't have a 3-hour commute and are stuck in a job for 8 hours. That's not something you're excited about, and can actually be really draining to be bored. So I felt like I was in Lord of the Rings, where Frodo tells Sam right before he goes like to the Grey Havens, or leaves a note, that he says, you need to be whole. You need to stop being a divided man. And I felt like so divided between two worlds. Like, it was so hard to be juggling a job that doesn't really interest you and you're constantly thinking about something else. I mean, I obviously would do a good job, but your heart's not fully in it. And then you have to also have the, after a draining day, the energy to do clients, network, as well as I had a fiance at the time and then who became a husband, and then you have friends and family, and then cleaning your house and taking out your dog. It's just the most exhausting thing. So I give tell everyone who's still doing that kind of life, like, keep at it, it'll pay off, but I sympathize with you deeply. But now that I have my own business and it's full time, I can dedicate the time to writing. I can sleep in instead of waking up at 4:45 a.m. every day to make sure I get out of work in time to do client calls like around 3 p.m. 4 p.m. So it's just really nice to have my own schedule, to have the freedom, and to have the energy and my cups full enough that I can actually focus my attention on my business and really give my clients the attention they deserve in my own creative pursuits. So yeah, it's been a huge change.
Yeah, it is all about finding that energy. And I like what you said about how being bored can actually sort of drain you, because that's really true. Like, it seems like if you're being filled up by a lot of like interesting creative things or different hobbies or just different people who are sort of pouring into you in that way, it's a lot easier for you to find the energy for your creative pursuits, and so that you can then in turn pour into other people, in your case, the clients that you work with. So have you found that you had like a lot more time to focus on your novel then? Did you like make much progress on it while you were working full time compared to after you quit?
Oh, yeah, it was a huge amount. So before, when I was working full-time with my novel, I would maybe write once. It's terrible. Like, once every 6 months, I might get 1,000 words in. I know that sounds, that was horrible, but it was because I was trying to do the side business to take full time. Yeah,
no.
So even though I thought it might be,
I'm laughing because I am in the exact same boat. I think it's been at least 6 months since I've touched this novel that I'm working on, and I just feel so guilty about it. But I also have a full-time job and a podcast and an hour commute and all of that kind of thing. So I really shouldn't feel as bad about it.
No, don't feel bad. I totally sympathize with people. All my clients are in this position. And I find that it helps just to do it. And the way I could get a little bit in occasionally would be I try writing on the train for 20 minutes. I was trying to do snatches, but I found I was a personality who needed to do. I'm one of those sit down, need a couple hours type personalities. So yeah, it was hard. I wouldn't do it for 6 months. So I totally sympathize with you because it's hard. We only have so many hours of a day and we want to spend time to our loved ones, spend time with our community, spend time with our side hustles, and you're limited. And I think we should be kinder to ourselves and give each other ourselves a pass that there's different seasons for everything. And it's okay sometimes to put the creative projects on hold, not permanently, but just maybe for a few months. Like when I was planning my wedding, totally forget even my side hustle with that one. But yeah, nowadays I have plenty of time. So I try, not always successfully, but most days, unless I'm totally swamped with the clients, I at least put 2 hours aside. My goal is always 1,000 words, and I write at least 1,000 words a day, more if I'm on a roll. And that is how I finish my novel in 3 months, is if you actually dedicate the time to it. And I had the time, and I could do it in the mornings when I was fresh and most energetic, and I could pound it out. It was how I was able to get it done. So yes, only focusing on one job as well as my novel, which is kind of now my side hustle, made a huge difference instead of having what I consider 2 side hustles.
Yeah, that is an impressive number of words in a day. Like, that is some serious writing you've got going on there.
What is amazing is the more you do it, the faster you get. So at first, 1,000 words would take me 3 or 4 hours, but by doing it enough, it can take me an hour now. So it's just amazing how much practice can make things go so much faster. And you also get over some of your fears about the blank page or writing, because you know you've done it before, so you have less hang-ups about, will I be able to come up with something today? You're just in the habit of producing. The muse, kind of, as Stephen King likes to talk about, will show up every day if you do, and he'll get on your schedule.
Yes. So now that you said that your novel is sort of your side hustle, now that your side hustle has become your full-time job, and you do a lot of editing and consulting for other writers, so do you ever run into trouble with pouring so much of your creative work and energy into your clients that you don't have enough left over for your own writing?
That is still a struggle. I'm going to be honest. It's really hard, especially after you've been reading words all day, to turn it off. Like, I read books now, like a Meg Cabot book, and I'm reading it, and there's still, like, comma splices all over the place, or a lot of books. I don't know what it is. Where are the editors? I want to know. But I still love Meg Cabot. But you still read it, and you can't help but notice all the grammar errors, which wasn't as much a thing even in my tech writing job, but now I do novels as my full-time gig. It's really hard. So it's always in your personal life, and then with your own writing, it just drains you. So that's why I always make it a priority to do in the morning, because if I try to write after doing client work, I'm like exhausted, I'm depleted. It will take me 3 hours to write 200 words if I do it at the end of the day. So that's why I really prioritize in the mornings, because I'm a morning person. That's where I'm freshest, and I think people need to find where their energy is. Some people are night owls, so I say go for it. If you are most inspired at 2 a.m. and you realistically can write at 2 a.m. with the life that you're living, I say go for it, because, yeah, it's so hard to write. Like, you have to make it a priority, I think, is the bottom line, because it's so easy for other things to take your time and attention away from it, in my case, my clients. And you have to put it first, because that way you're not resentful of the other obligations you have in life, because it's not, you have already done what's right for you. And I find I'm more energetic and I'm more, like, eager and just happy when I have done my writing, and I can do a better job on my clients' work when I have done my writing. So I think by making it a priority, it'll make you show up better in other places in your life. And I think especially as a woman, not to make a generalization, but I've known that with the clients I've talked to and the people, it's really hard not to feel selfish when you prioritize your creative work. But I think in the end, it is ultimately going to help other people if your cup is full and that you're doing what you love, because you will have more to give.
Yeah, that is such an amazing observation. I know a lot of times, you know, as, you know, women and as wives and as moms and all of that kind of thing, like we tend to give the best of ourselves to everybody else around us because we feel these obligations and don't always kind of leave enough to do something for ourselves. So it's wonderful that you've kind of figured out that you're a better person overall and you work better if you're doing something that makes you happy first or just as much as any other work for other people.
Yes, I think it's really like to put my main dream is to become a full-time writer. And I'm like, I love editing. I love my clients. But I think it's very important to always remember what your ultimate dream is. Your ultimate goal is for me to be like the next Suzanne Collins or Leigh Bardugo. And it's just important to remember that, keep that in mind and prioritize that. And I think it will help you help other people and it makes you more jazzed for everything. And yeah, I just think it's really important to like write it on a card, stick it on your mirror, whatever it takes is to remember this is my goal and to keep working towards it and make it a non-negotiable, kind of like you wouldn't stand up a friend for dinner. Or you shouldn't stand up your muse for a writing date or whatever it is, painting, whatever your artistic bent may be.
I really like that. So how, now that, you know, writing and editing client work and things all day long is your day job, and your side hustle has become kind of writing. Have you picked up any new hobbies that, you know, aren't about words and aren't about grammar that kind of allow you to just kind of unwind or unplug at the end of the day?
This was actually my biggest challenge, I would say, when I took my writing and my editing full time, because I love it. It was always my passion to edit. I'd edit my friends' books for free when it was not my full gig. And I just enjoyed it, like beta reading. I love reading books. It's obviously one of my favorite things. It was my first word. But once I've made it my full-time thing, I realized it's not sustainable to have that as your only interest. So then I developed other ones. So I got into photography a little bit. I'm getting into it. But then I find it's still looping into my business. So it's so hard not to somehow appropriate everything you pick up back into your business. So what I've ultimately concluded is the way I best unplug from my business or my writing is, in words, is to actually go outside the house. Because I work from home. It's always a struggle not to check my email like at 11 at night or think about client work or editing or just be in that world. So I find by going on traveling, like day trips, or spending time with friends is huge, or other people, because it's so rude to pull out your phone or read or something during that time. So it forces me to be really present in those instances. So that's how I unplug. And also just getting out kind of detaches, and looking at the world around me detaches kind of the hyperverbal part of my brain and just helps me be really present and unplug. So it's more of, I've decided by being with people, like going to plays, watching movies, like going, watching a TV show at my friend's house, it's more visual and less verbal. Even though there's verbal elements, it still helps me unwind and not focus as much on my job. And also exercise, as cliche as it sounds, is really huge. Like, I love dancing and I want to get back into yoga, and that's really a good way for me to stop being writer, editor, reader, Sarah all the time and realize there's other parts of myself that also need to be tended to and not be in work mode all the time.
Yeah, I agree that doing something more physical or hands-on tends to complement itself really well if the type of creativity you do is something like writing, where it's more mind work. For me, that usually looks like knitting or cooking or baking or something. But I also, you know, I've done yoga in the past. I have trouble getting to it now with the two kids, but yoga for sure was a great way, like just emptying your brain and like being mindful and focusing on something else for an hour. Like, I know you do yoga regularly, don't you, Abby?
Yes, I'm definitely trying to, especially during this pregnancy, go every Monday to prenatal yoga and just shut my brain off for an hour and a half. And it's really, really helpful.
How do you shut your brain off completely during yoga? Because when they tell you at the end to just meditate, my mind still races. Do you have tips to get to that point where you can completely clear your brain? Because I can never quite not do that.
I don't know that I ever completely clear my brain, because I'm that classic overthinker about all sorts of things. But you're just thinking about such completely different things for me. I'm thinking about, you know, like the tension that I feel, or You know, how could I, you know, reposition my hips to get into this pose a little bit better or a little bit deeper? It just kind of helps me, I guess, stop checking things off of a list. And that is what I think drives me crazy most of the time, is I am definitely a planner and definitely a list maker. And I want like everything to be just completely prescribed out for me by myself. Of course, I want to make those lists and I want to check those things off. And so going to yoga and just literally doing what someone else tells you to do for an hour is kind of refreshing.
Yes.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Like I try to figure out why I feel like I'm always working during the day, even though I've started tracking my time this year, and I really only spend like 1, maybe 2 hours a day working. But I feel like I'm working all the time because mm-hmm. my mind is always racing. And like you said, like it's focusing on the to-do list and on what else you have to do. And sometimes even writing it down doesn't get it off my mind. But like you said, when you're in yoga or if you're running or something, you can really focus on something physical and on your body and how you could like do this pose, or for me, like if it's a balance pose, like don't fall over, or at the end where they tell you to just meditate, I don't really even so much meditate as sit there thinking like, mm-hmm. wow, my back feels amazing yeah. right now. like there aren't necessarily any like super high level philosophical thoughts going on. It's more so just like, yeah, that was good. I could fall asleep yes. right now.
Naps are often very close to the mind at the end of a yoga practice.
That's so true.
Totally.
Yeah. So do you have any routines or rituals that kind of help you get into the right headspace to work on your novel? Or you said you do it kind of first thing in the morning. It's what you kind of prioritize and do first thing in the day. Is there anything that kind of helps, you know, jog your brain and get it in that mode?
Yes. I always pick an album for every book I write. So my last novel I wrote to the Bleachers Only album. If anyone knows if there's another one coming out, hit me up because I would love to listen to it. But it has to be, it's like there's this really strange exact formula I have for the soundtrack I picked for the book. So I picked the Bleachers for this one because it's a young adult novel, and the Bleachers describe their album as a John Hughes film, whom I love, and an album. So, and I think they pretty much capture the high school kind of 80s sort of feeling. And while my book wasn't set in the 80s, I kind of love the 80s. So it really also helped my aesthetic taste. But it has to be one I've heard enough that it's not distracting. So I've mm-hmm. listened to that album on repeat on road trips or whatever. So when I put it in, I can work, and I even let it go on repeat. And it has to be one that I don't get sick of. And the thing that is magical about it is after you've done it for about a week, it's like Pavlovian. So as soon as I hear it, I have the urge to write, which can be inconvenient when I'm in a car and the song comes on the radio and they're like, where's my pen and paper? I need to get it down. So that's something I do. And it's always a different album that fits kind of the theme of the book. But yeah, it has to have words for some reason. It kind of keeps my momentum up. But that's what I do to get in the zone for it.
That's super interesting, because I've heard of a lot of authors talk about the music they write to, but I always sort of just pictured it as like, oh, they just like having background music on when they work, like kind of how I'll just put on like a random like Pandora station or whatever while I'm doing writing for work. But I've never heard anyone talk about it the way you did, where it's like, oh, I hear this music and now it's like, okay, it's time to write now. Like, I really like that. And if I ever get around to like tackling a big writing project, which is just not something I have space for at the moment, but if I do in a few years, that's totally a trick I'm going to use, because that is a great way to trick your brain into writing more and being more productive that way.
It's really amazing. And I will also give one more nudge towards people to write first thing in the morning, because if you write first thing in the morning, you don't, to put a no other, I can't think of another way to put it, but it's your brain's not polluted yet. So for example, I'm writing this young adult book, and I read Jane Austen's Persuasion right before one day I stupidly waited till midday to write it. So I just finished reading Persuasion for a book review. So my character started talking way too formally, which is a no-go for a high school cafeteria. So when I reread it, I'm like, wait, this was when I was reading Persuasion, wasn't it? Because it was just ridiculously like they were in a Regency ballroom. So I encourage people to like write first thing, because you're not, other people's ideas aren't maybe floating in your subconscious or other people's words. So I think that's when you can get closest to your voice or your character's voices and get what you need without any outside influence. It's the way I get fresh starts. So my characters, I can't even imagine what it'd be like if I wrote read Dracula right before writing that book. But so it's a good way to get a fresh start.
Yes, that is very true. The words we're reading often infiltrate what we're writing, for sure. So speaking of the words that we've been reading, you are also a professional editor. And I know as an editor myself that it's hard to turn off your editing brain. So like you said, you'll be reading just for fun and you'll notice all the comma splices. Like, I have that same problem where sometimes I have to remind myself, like, you can read faster. You don't have to read every single word. You don't have to focus on mistakes, like put away the red pen. Nobody cares. So do you ever have trouble turning off that editor brain when you're doing your own writing? Or do you have any tips that help you write those crappy first drafts just to get the words down on paper?
Sure. Oddly enough, I've found being an editor really liberates me with that. So I have many clients who are like talented, beautiful, like great ideas, wonderful prose. I think they're great. And I realize their first drafts, I see them. They're not perfect. And then so if you read enough of them, and they're brilliant people, and they have great books for the world, you realize everyone's looks like that. So by the sheer volume, you see that you realize no one's perfect. And because I'm an editor, I'm gladly, maybe is a better way to put it, read a lot of writing books. I absorb them and listen to author interviews. And then when you hear people like Neil Gaiman say he gets like 50 pages into a draft and always wants to throw it away and he thinks it's terrible, it helps to know you're not alone in this. And because of that, it helps me kind of ignore any of those voices. Also, I'll not reread anything I've written until the end, except for maybe a line or two just to orient me into what the scene is or the chapter. I will not reread it. So I found that if I try to reread my books, like let's say I reread a good chunk of it, I start getting into editor mode. So by not knowing or remembering much what I wrote before, other than what I have in my outline or what I can remember just from sheer memory, it forces me not to be uber critical because I don't see it. Also, writing just notes in the margins help. Just it gives me a sense of like, okay, I'll get back to this. And I have to keep repeating, just keep writing. It's okay, that's terrible. And it helps to have friends you can call or a community that will say, you can call them and say, I keep wanting to edit this. Help me get out of it. And they just say, keep going. Just like Dory said, just keep swimming. Just keep writing. So I think the key is really just keeping that mind that everyone's is not great, so just keep pushing through. And also as an editor, you realize a lot of people ditch their first chapter, so if you're obsessing about the first chapter, it might be deleted anyways, or the paragraph you're worried about, it might be cut. And every single person I've talked to that hasn't finished it, their draft, and they've been trying for years, right? This is usually people, it's been like 10 years. It's because they keep rewriting the book. So whether it's they throw it away halfway through and start again, or they're still stuck on the first chapter, I think the quickest way to not finish your book is to constantly rewrite it. So you can edit all you want once you've gotten on the page, but I find people who are stuck in the writing are the ones who are doing an endless editing loop.
Yeah, I could definitely see where that would be progress hindering. I have done a little bit of that myself, of course. But that's what I've always heard too, is you can't edit words that you don't write or that aren't on the paper to begin with. So just get words on the paper and you can come back. Nobody has to see the crappiest of crappy first drafts. You can give someone else a second draft if you really want to.
It's true. And I love how Anne Lamott says in Bird by Bird that she's always terrified she'll get killed in a car accident when she's in the middle of a rough draft because she doesn't want anyone to see it. I think that helps a lot, too, is knowing that it shuts up your inner editor to know people as talented as she is still worry about dying in car crashes when they're writing their rough drafts.
I suppose, does that need to go in like every writer's will? If I die, please throw my computer into the ocean and don't let anyone download anything off of it.
I've told my husband, I've sent him, whenever I finish a draft, I go, do not read this under any circumstances. But should I, God forbid, pass away, send it to these people for editing, and I trust them with it. But no, like I said, but you're not allowed to read it until then. It's always in these bold capital letters because you know that only tempts me to read it. I'm like, no, it's not ready. It's not ready yet. And there's always a bit of trepidation when you send it to someone for review, even as an editor.
Yeah. I think it does help to know as an editor yourself that, like, the people who review your work and who read it for you aren't sitting there like, wow, what an idiot. They're actually like, I mean, we're all coming from a good place of like trying to help each other and build each other up and improve our writing. And unfortunately, that does involve criticism and rewriting and all that stuff. But it's unless you have like the world's worst editor, like it's not coming from a place of like, I don't know, negativity, I guess, or like nobody's sitting there making fun of you because we all start at that same crappy first draft place. So yes, I can see how that would be helpful.
Yeah, it's amazing that people who are so, I don't know, we're not evil villains who are twirling our mustaches or like putting our hands together while we hit our fingernails against each other. No, like I'm totally sympathetic to my clients. I'm not judging them. I'm helping them. And everyone's been there. It's only from a place of complete empathy, and I actually think there's always beautiful things to every draft. So it's, I wish I could tell people, no, we're not judging you, we've been there ourselves, we're like your comrades in arms, we totally get it.
Yes.
That's a good reminder for everybody that the book that they end up pulling off the bookshelf at the bookstore has gone through a dozen rewrites, and that it started as just a bunch of words on a page two that didn't make any sense.
Yes, I don't think there's a writer out there who doesn't edit their work at least multiple times. I've gone to tons of writing talks, and I've heard of people who've done 13 rewrites. I know Hemingway rewrote his endings at least 32 times, and The Sun Also Rises in particular was the one with over 32 revisions for its ending. So no, not even people like Hemingway magically just come up with this perfect ending. It takes a lot of work, and unfortunately you feel like you're done when you're done with the first draft, but it's only the beginning, and that's maybe in my experience 15% of the work, and there's still 85% to go.
Yep, you just gotta keep pushing.
So at the end of every episode, we love to talk about books, of course, and we think that you're going to love this part as well, Sarah. So what are some favorite books that you have that you want to talk about? And it can be your favorite YA books that kind of inspired you to become a writer. It could be your favorite books on writing or creativity, or it could even be as simple as just what you're reading now. So tell us about a couple of your favorites.
Okay, this is my favorite question. I'm super excited. So my first recommendation is I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, which is, I think, it wasn't when YA existed, but I think falls safely in that category. I don't ever hear people talking about the book, even though there was a movie, which I didn't like as much, with Bill Nighy and the guy who plays Superman. But it's this book about a girl who lives in a castle, and I think it's between the two world wars, if I remember correctly. And it's really smart. It references Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte. The narrator's a really strong voice. The characters are really colorful and unlike others you'll meet before, and there's ideas in the book that stick with you. So, for example, she went to a department store and just was thinking about how luxurious it was, and now every time I walk into a department store, I think of her, Cassandra the character, and think about, I can see how you would think this is luxurious with all the perfume, makeup, shoes. And it's just one of those books, I will give you a warning, I had an experience of reading it where it's called the Little Women Syndrome, as I like to call it, where the character picks what you think makes horrible romantic decisions, and you want to jump into the book and, like in a horror film, tell them, don't go towards the window, don't pick this person, go with the other one, and you want to rewrite it. But despite that, the book is, or maybe because of that, you could argue, the book is really wonderful, and it's a great coming of age one, and I would definitely tell people to put on their list. Most people I know haven't heard of it, but when they've read it, they love it. At least females do. I haven't tried giving it to a male yet. It seems like a very feminine book, but I think it could be universal. And it does deal with writing. Her father's a writer, so there's some interesting ideas there as well about writing.
Yeah, I've actually had that one recommended to me before, and it's just been shelved on like the never ending Goodreads list of books I want to read eventually and haven't gotten to yet. So now you're just one more person who's like bumping it back to the top of my list.
Bump it to the top. It's a good read. I really, really love it. And I think you would enjoy it if you like writing. You'll definitely love it. As for books about writing, I really love Story Engineering by Larry Brooks. My friend Jennifer Blanchard recommended it, and it did change my life with writing. Once you read it, you can't unsee things. So it's a book that basically tells you major plot points, how most books are structured. It's really good for people who struggle with outlining. It goes over like sort of a formula most books follow, especially commercial and even movies. And he uses primarily actually movie examples because you can watch it quickly if you don't know it and learn about the craft. And then you'll start watching a film or reading a fantasy novel and you'll be like, darn it, I'm starting to recognize all the plot points he's talking about in the structure. So it's really cool because it makes it accessible in a way that I haven't seen before. And he goes over like four acts and everything. And it just kind of whole changed the way I write. And it just changes the game for you. And it prevents you from writing very episodic novels, which I'm guilty of, and really makes it conflict driven. And the characters are more rounded and there's really motivation and antagonistic forces. So if you're really struggling with how do you plot a novel, that is a book I cannot recommend enough to people.
Oh, that sounds really, really good. I keep meaning to read more books about writing just to kind of get me back in that frame of mind. But I'm finding that books that, like Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird or whatever, they're all about like the craft and the words and, you know, putting stuff down on paper. But I've never read anything about like how stories are structured. So I think Story Engineering might be going to the top of my list.
I found that too. That's why I was really drawn to it, because people like Stephen King's book, which I'm obsessed with, On Writing, I also really enjoy that one. It's really cool to hear behind the scenes of a writer, and he has some cool ideas like about the muse and writing practice, but I had yet to find one that I felt really broke it down in super concrete terms with really strong examples of how you actually do it. It's like a standard operating procedure to go full circle with my career of like how you actually write a novel. And it's, I feel like you can handle anything. Like, even goes over theme and characters and briefly voice. And it's why we write is we want people to buy it. And I think the book sets up people really well to getting an agent if that's they want, or at least doing really well if you're self-publishing. And it makes books that people want to turn the pages for, which I know there's like with some literary fiction, which I can debate the title with some people. I don't know if I think that's a real category, but people are like, oh, they elevate that. And I think there is a place for it, but it's also nice that the book gives commercial fiction, I think it's due, genre fiction it's due. And I find it like it celebrates just creating a really good story that people can't put down, which is why I read personally. Maybe I'm just not deep enough, but I don't want to read for deep philosophical themes. Great if it's there, but I ultimately want to be pulled in and forget the rest of the world exists.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like a good book for, like you said, people who don't necessarily know how to outline, which is me. Although I'm not sure if I'm ever going to write fiction or write longer fiction anyway. So that's definitely one that I will be picking up if I do decide that my writing life is going to go down that path. So were there any other books that you wanted to talk about, Sarah?
Sure. I'm also currently on my nightstand, among many others. I have a problem where I read like five at once, is Anna Kendrick's Scrappy Little Nobody.
That's on my list.
And I'm obsessed. It's so good. I'm obsessed with Anna Kendrick. When I do those, I don't know, you're in the online business space, so you probably know these. You know those like copy questionnaires to figure out what your brand would be for your business? Mm-hmm. They say like, what celebrity would your business be? And I'm always like, Anna Kendrick. I just think she's hilarious on Twitter. She has a beautiful voice. I love her, the characters she tends to play. And so reading this book, as Book Riot described it, is like having coffee with her, and I want to be her best friend, so it's kind of a dream come true reading this book. It's just funny, it's well-written, it's really smart, and I really recommend it to people. If you want just like a light celebrity read, which I'm getting more into, it's really just a fun book if you wanted something to like go to sleep to or something just kind of light for a road trip or something.
That's really good to hear, because I have been in the vein of like having to read different celebrity memoirs for book club in the past 6 or 8 months, and all of them have kind of fallen flat to me. And so when I heard that Anna Kendrick was coming out with one, she's actually a celebrity that, like you've said, I love following her on Twitter. I think she's hilarious. I was hoping that her celebrity memoir would be good, and I'm glad to hear that you're enjoying it.
I don't know if it's ghostwritten or not. I always wonder this with all the celebrity memoirs I read. I'm like, is it ghostwritten? Mm-hmm. I would like to believe she could write it, but this one I'm not Sure, but it's really well written. So either she's a fabulous writer or she has a really good ghostwriter. And it's her voice. Like, you can hear her speak, which I really enjoy with books, is when you can actually hear the person's voice in your head. And it's her sense of humor, and it's very true to her. And based on her Twitter, I'm inclined to think she probably wrote it herself. And it's just kind of self-deprecating and fun. And I always enjoy reading behind the scenes. Also, a celebrity memoir I read, which I really loved, was Mara Wilson's Where Am I Now? I love that one. That one was really well written. I know she wrote it because that's where her career is. And I just loved hearing about Robin Williams and Matilda. And, oh, it was so funny. And it was just a really smart book. And it was said some really interesting things about life. So it maintained its kind of humor, but still had serious moments and still had kind of takeaways for the reader, but done in a very entertaining way with a not a heavy hand. So also, if you're looking for a celebrity kind of memoir or essay collection, I highly recommend hers.
Yeah, I've heard good things about that one too. And I'm a little bit like you, Abby, with the celebrity memoirs, where I've read a lot of the popular ones, and the only ones that I've really liked so far have been both of Mindy Kaling's memoirs. Yes. I think they're hilarious.
I love them. But
I'm on the library hold list for both Anna Kendrick's and the new one out by Lauren Graham. I think it's called Talking as Fast as I Can. And of course, like a million people want it. So I'm on the list forever. And I'll probably read them in like a year, but I have very high hopes for them.
I really want to read Lauren Graham's. I've heard the audiobook is amazing. So I sampled it. Mm-hmm. And she talks so quickly during it, which I should be used to with Gilmore Girls, but as a fellow fast talker, I still was having trouble following it, so I'm like, I'm going to get the actual book, even though I have friends who love it, the audiobook, and also mentions pictures, and it drives me nuts when I can't actually look at the image described in an audiobook.
I've never actually thought about that. I've literally never, like, listened to an audiobook that had pictures in it, and I've never thought about that hurdle that they would have to overcome.
Yeah, I first discovered that issue when I was listening to the audiobook of Special Topics in Calamity Physics, which is also a really great book, and I would highly recommend. But I listened to it when I was exercising, and then I actually bought the physical book, because so much of it depends on the images. Like, since it's a mystery, they mention Exhibit A, Exhibit B, and there's these really cool illustrations. I love the illustrative style of whoever her artist was. Maybe it was herself, I don't know, but they're just beautiful. I really like the aesthetic, so it just was missing a lot with the audiobooks. So you have to be careful, I think, especially with memoirs or self-help or really weird fiction books where there might be stuff that depends on illustration. So you have to just watch out.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So, Ashley, have you been reading anything lately that you'd like to mention?
I don't know, because I'm like, for people listening who don't know this, Abby and I have recorded like 3 episodes this week. So we keep asking each other if we've read anything lately, but really it's like, I just talked to you yesterday. What have you read since yesterday?
The answer is the internet. We've read the internet.
I think we're kind of running out of things that we've read. There is a book that I just finished, but I'm not even sure if I should talk about it because I didn't really like it. And I always feel bad. Like, I don't want to feel like I'm bashing on books, even though I feel like I have a reputation for that now, because I have all these books I don't like that everyone else loves. And this is, based on its Goodreads rating, another book I hate that everybody else loves.
Aww.
What book is it? Or should you tell me after the recording? I now want to know so I can avoid it or read it out of curiosity.
Well, I'll talk about it and I'll just say like what I didn't like about it and what I can tell people did like about it. So the book is Swear on This Life by Renee Carlino. And I picked it up based on the premise and the very high Goodreads reviews. And the premise is that there's this new best-selling novel and this girl picks it up and reads it and realizes that it's about her childhood. And the author, who wrote under sort of a pseudonym name, was the best friend that she grew up with and now sort of wrote this book from her point of view about her childhood and is selling it as this best-selling novel. And of course, they were like childhood loves. And so there's a love story in there as well. And she goes to confront him and stuff and whatever. And the premise I found very intriguing, but the writing fell completely flat for me. Like, it felt like a little bit more of an early draft and less of something polished. And I didn't think that the characters were as deep as they could have been. And a lot of the moments that you could tell were supposed to be like heavy plot moments didn't carry that much emotional weight for me. So I didn't like it. But a lot of other people disagree with me. Like, I'm looking at the Goodreads page and it has almost 10,000 reviews and 4.17 stars. So I am like way in the minority.
I find that being an editor makes me pickier. So I wonder if you suffer mm-hmm. the same fate, where as an editor, it's really hard just to relax and go with the flow. You're always analyzing things nonstop.
Yeah, I do that. And I know that like everybody values different things when they read, like you were talking about how you really like being pulled into a story. And I appreciate that as well. But I also really like beautiful language and beautiful prose. And mm-hmm. This book just didn't meet that for me, to the point where I almost found myself stumbling over the dialogue a little bit because it was just not flowing for me. So the problem is probably with me and not with the book. But that's just what I thought about it.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, I always love what Austin Kleon, the writer and artist, mm-hmm. says is, instead of like having to say or to confess, like, I didn't like that, or I thought that book was dumb, or I didn't, you know, that TV show is stupid or whatever, just he always responds with, it wasn't for me, which I think is the most like lovely and diplomatic way to say any of those previously mentioned phrases.
Yes. Very gracious.
It wasn't for me.
How about you, Abby? Have you read anything new since yesterday?
Since, yeah, 24 hours ago? No, I have not. I ridiculously have not had time at all in the past week to, like, sit down and read a book, period, between, like, classes in the evenings and podcasting and all that fun stuff. But I have, nerd that I am, made a list of books that I'm going to read next, if that's Ooh. Not book nerd enough for you all.
Acceptable.
I'm actually planning to reread a couple of favorites. I've been kind of in a reading slump, and I feel like I need something to like jog me back out of it. So I want to reread Essentialism this spring. That is top of my list. And then I'm also planning to reread for book club, actually, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet by Jamie Ford. Have either of you guys read that one?
Mm-mm. I haven't, no.
Oh, it's one of my favorites. It's just this really sweet story about these like 13, 14-year-old kids in Seattle in, I believe, like the 1940s during World War II. It's just this really adorable, really easy to read novel, but it's beautifully done, beautifully written, and just one of those that like every time you go back to it, it's like just a little hug in a book.
I have to read this now. That sounds
amazing.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's going really on adorable. And it's one of those like novels that I always read with a pencil because I want to like underline all of the phrases. So you guys should definitely read that one. I own it. This is my test of like a truly good book, as I own it in both paperback and hardcover. So I can loan out the copy that I don't like as well to other people and not worry about not getting it back.
I have a strict one. That's amazing. I have a very strict one. I have to trust. You have to be a certain type of person for me to loan a book for you. I have to know that you won't dog-ear the pages like my husband did when we were first dating. That was a big fight. Like, you do not dog-ear the pages.
No.
Yeah. I don't dog-ear pages either, unless I'm like, I don't know, if it was like a textbook desperate for college or something, then I probably would, just for reference purposes, because it's like, I'm going to have to write a literary analysis of this soon. But my own personal books, no. I'll write in the margins, though, for sure.
Yeah. I will sit there and like attempt to memorize the page number that I'm on before I will dog ear something. That's ridiculous. But, you know, I'll just like sit there and repeat like 102, 102, 102. You'll remember that. You'll remember it. You're on page 102.
Yeah. Although, have you guys heard of book darts?
No.
Book darts?
I've never used. Yes, book darts. It sounds awful, like you throw darts at books, but that's not what you do.
That's reassuring.
I think I first heard about them from Modern Mrs. Darcy's blog, but they're these little like I don't even know how you explain them. They're these like little fold over like gold foil things that you fold on the edge of a page, and it makes like an arrow pointing pretty much at the line that you would want to remember or underline, so you don't have to underline or anything. But then because it folds around the page, it also makes like a convenient little, like, you can just look at the spine and see where all your book darts are, and then you can like flip back quickly to everywhere you had wanted to return to eventually. I don't know. I haven't used them before, but it seems like a very good idea. I'd probably have to buy way too many because I would use them all immediately.
Yeah. I just use like the little post-it note stickies, like the flags, the post-it flags. And then I tend to try to reuse them too because they're expensive.
This is true.
Yeah, so there's just little like stacks of them periodically throughout the house, and Scott's like, do you want all your bookmarks back? It's like, yes I do.
Gather them all up and use them again.
Exactly. So more money for books, people. We're not gonna spend it on post-it notes.
Priorities.
Yeah.
It is. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sarah.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a blast.
Yes, it is always good talking to fellow word lovers and book lovers. So before we let you go, do you want to let everybody know where they can find you on the internet and social media?
Yeah, stop by and say hi. I'm at www.thebookishfox.com. And all my handles are pretty much Bookish Sarah Fox. So again, that's Bookish Sarah Fox. So it's on Instagram, Twitter. That's pretty much my handle you can find.
Awesome. Well, it was great talking to you again, and we hope to talk to you again soon. Have a great night. Thanks for listening to the Chasing Creative podcast. If you like what you heard in this episode, be sure to stop by chasingcreative.com to check out the show notes, catch up on past episodes, and subscribe to the podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you leave us a review on iTunes. You can also join in the creative conversation by tweeting to us at Abigail E. Krebs or at Brooks Editorial, or by using the hashtag ChasingCreative on Twitter and Instagram.
If there's a guest you'd love to hear from on the podcast, or if you have any feedback for us, drop us a line at chasingcreativepodcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. Until next week, go chase your creative.